Thank you, worship team. And thanks for having me today. It's always good and a little surprising to be invited back to any church where I've spoken before. The only feedback I got from the last visit was that I didn't preach long enough. Now, no one actually said that, but you know, I can read between the lines. I can pick that kind of stuff up. My dad is fond of quoting the old advice that a good sermon should have a strong beginning and a strong finish, and the two should be as close together as possible. I don't know if I'm going to live up to that advice this morning, but if you're one of those people that felt like the last time I was here I didn't preach long enough, relax, I'm going to fix that this morning. Okay. I'm not very tech savvy. The church where I pastored for a long time was about as low tech as you can imagine. So I'm not used to PowerPoints and things like that. So if you don't mind, I'm going to ignore whatever is behind me. And if I would ask that you do too, I suppose. But I would like you to turn with me to John chapter 21. There is a reference there to 1 Corinthians 15. That reference there is the Apostle Paul recounting the post-resurrection appearances of Jesus. Those occasions in which he interacted with other people after his resurrection, and specifically that Paul testified to the fact that Jesus didn't just do this once or twice and with just a couple of individuals, but rather that he appeared to numerous people on many occasions, and that there were many eyewitnesses to that resurrection who were still alive in Paul's day. In other words, he was trying to stress the point that if anybody doubted these accounts or if anybody doubted the reality of the resurrection of Jesus, you could actually go and talk to eyewitnesses because Jesus did appear to these various people and he had these conversations and there were eyewitnesses to that. Now, one of these occasions is recorded in John's at the end of John's Gospel, chapter 21. And I'm going to read this for you and then try to draw some lessons from it. At verse 15 of John 21, when they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you truly love me more than these?" "Yes, Lord," he said, "you know that I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my lambs." Again, Jesus said, "Simon, son of John, do you truly love me?" He answered, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus said, "Take care of my sheep." The third time he said to him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, "Do you love me?" He said, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my sheep. I tell you the truth, when you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted, but when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go." Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. Then he said to him, "Follow me." Peter turned and saw that the disciple whom Jesus loved was following them. This was the one who had leaned back against Jesus at the supper and had said, "Lord, who is going to betray you?" When Peter saw him, he asked, "Lord, what about him?" Jesus answered, "If I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? You must follow me." I wonder if people had bumper stickers on the backs of their donkeys that said, "A good day for a bad day fishing is better than a good day at work." This is one of the occasions of Jesus' post-resurrection appearances. It occurs on the Sea of Galilee, and it's after a little fishing trip. If you read the rest of the chapter, you'll realize that the disciples had gone out fishing, not knowing quite what to do with themselves after Jesus' resurrection. And his instructions to wait for power to visit them. And so they return to doing what they have done before. After all, they've got to eat. And so they go fishing, but they are unsuccessful. And Jesus appears on the shore and directs Peter and the guys to let down their nets again. And lo and behold, they draw in a bumper crop of fish. This leads to a little deja vu moment for Peter. You know, if you know Peter's story with Jesus, he probably says, "Hey, wait a minute, I've seen this kind of thing before." And it dawns on him who it is that has given them the instructions. It also leads to breakfast for everybody. They get to the shore and Jesus is grilling fish, and after breakfast, he grills Peter just a little bit. He asks Peter three times if Peter loves him, which might seem like, you know, he's punishing him a little. After all, think how ashamed and anguished Peter must have felt. He denied Jesus three times in his hour of need, and now Jesus is sort of bringing this all out right within the group of the inner 12. It might seem like Jesus is rubbing salt in the wound just a little bit, but he's not at all. What he is actually doing is publicly reinstating Peter. In front of everybody, he's giving Peter the opportunity to declare again his loyalty and his love for Jesus. And Jesus accepts that and affirms it by then commissioning Peter with responsibilities. Feed my sheep. Feed my lambs. It's a way of publicly declaring that Peter is back in the position that he had before he failed Jesus. It's a way of Jesus saying, I trust you and I know that I can rely upon you. After that moment, though, there's a kind of a weird change of direction in the story. I often thought how the Bible writers, if they, you know, were really thinking about producing something persuasive, wouldn't have put these little odd bits and sort of subplots in, because it doesn't flow very well all the time. You know, if they had consulted with some Hollywood script writers, they may have found, you know, a much smoother, happy ending, complete with theme music. But instead, we get sort of this real-life change of direction, and it's almost illustrative of what Jesus is talking about here. It seems like Peter's, after getting this reinstatement and this recommission, suddenly Peter is distracted by looking over at this other disciple over here. Now, we know it's John because John always refers to himself in the third person in the Gospels, but we know it's him. So he looks over at John. He says, oh, well, Jesus, what about him? He's immediately distracted. Immediately his focus has changed to something else. And this presents the opportunity for Jesus to say, what is that to you? You follow me. You know, one of the things that makes the Bible ring true to me is that it isn't written like propaganda. It isn't written like so everything ties neatly together and has this seamless, persuasive tone to it. It reads like real life, and it reads a little bit like the way we think and we act, warts and all. You know, the uplifting stuff and the embarrassing stuff, it's all there together, and it just has that ring of truth and reality to it. Peter asks if this disciple will live to see Jesus return, and as he mentioned, a rumor gets going, and in fact, that he would live until Jesus returned, but Jesus never promised that. In any case, Jesus responds in verse 22 in a way that, again, may sound a little bit harsh. He says, what's that to you? Or what's it to you? In verse 23, the whole exchange is repeated, and Jesus asks of Peter, what's it to you? You follow me. Now, it's important to understand this question and the way that it is said, because it'd be easy to misunderstand it. So I'm going to, in fact, it's probably more important that we understand this question nowadays than even at the time that Jesus asked it. There have been tremendous changes in our society just in the last decade. There have been tremendous changes within Christianity in America just in the last decade that make this question so important to understand and to respond to. So I'm going to pull three quick lessons out of this passage, this little back and forth between Jesus and Peter. Anyone catch that lie? Quick? All right. When preachers stretch the truth, it's called speaking evangelistically. All right, we're just... By quick, I don't mean that it's necessarily going to be short. It just means that I'm not going to say everything that could be said about all of these things. The first thing we must do to understand Jesus' question is make sure that we don't misunderstand it. What does the question mean? Because the way that we put things can easily make the very same phrase mean two very different things, can't it? Have you ever been around somebody who's a little bit quiet and you ask them, you know, how are you? And they answer, fine. Oh, I'm fine. And, you know, it's fine. Have you ever asked the same question to somebody and the response is, I'm fine. Do the things mean the same? Same words, same response, but you know something very different here. You know, if my wife says, I'm fine, I know she's not fine, is she? You know, it reminds me of the story of the man who found a lamp on a beach, and he polished it off, and poof, as these stories go, this genie pops out. And the man says, wow, it's a genie. I've heard about these things. He said, do I get my three wishes? And the genie says, sorry, there have been cutbacks. You only get one. And the guy goes, oh, wow. He said, thinks for a while. What am I going to do with my one wish? And he finally decides, you know what? He said, I've always wanted to visit Hawaii, but I'm terrified to fly. And you know, I get seasick on boats. He said, what I would like you to do, genie, is to build a bridge from California to Hawaii so I could just drive there and drive back. The genie goes, are you kidding me? He said, you know how far away that is? Do you know how much concrete and asphalt? Do you know how deep those pilings have got to go? He said, is there anything else that you could wish for instead? The guy thinks for a minute. He goes, you know what? He said, I've always wanted to understand how women think. The genie says, do you want that bridge four lanes or two? So we can say the same thing. It can be fine, and they can mean two very, very different things. For example, you can say, you know, what's the matter with you? And it can be a sincere investigation into somebody's condition, right? You know, is everything all right? What's the matter with you? Or you can say, what's the matter with you? To imply, you know, you already know what's the matter with them. There's something seriously wrong. When we read Jesus saying, what is it to you? We might see it as a sincere question that Peter's got to respond to. Or it might be simply a way of us hearing, mind your own business, Peter. Well, I think it's a little more like the first than the second. There is an element here of what's it to you when Peter refers to this other disciple over here, and Jesus said, well, what's it to you? There is an element of mind your own business here. We have that all the time. Anybody who has children know that children love to report to their parents what the other child is doing. And how frequently do we say, you know, what's that to you? I'm right here. I'm the parent. I can handle this. Yes, Lydia, I know that Billy isn't eating her green beans, but we can handle it. You know, what's that to you? You attend to your own green beans. Jesus reminds us that reminds Peter that John is not his responsibility. He's Jesus' responsibility. Peter's responsibility is to follow Jesus. Now, as anyone who has talked to me for more than 5 minutes knows, I have a deep dislike for social media. I don't do Facebook or Twitter or blogs, and I dislike the ability that we have now to comment on everything that turns up in the news and then to comment on everybody else's comments. And it's given our whole generation in this country the idea that we should tell everybody about everything that is going on in our lives and comment about everything that's going on in everybody else's lives. I think there's been a sad loss of privacy. There's been a sad loss of a decorous way of interacting with one another, and an alarming rise in the anxiety that comes with the preoccupation of what everybody else is thinking. And you don't have to wonder what everybody else is thinking because they're all saying it somewhere on social media. In a very important sense, we really do need to mind our own business. What's all that other stuff to us? What is it to us? But that's as far as I want to go with that, because I actually think that the other direction that we can go and is even more dangerous, and that's the first thing that I want to pull out of Jesus' question. So if you're a writer down of notes, this is the first of three things that I want to pull out of this exchange. Firstly, what's it to you means feeding my sheep. Feeding my sheep. In other words, minding your own business does not negate being your brother's keeper. Focusing on Jesus and following him does not negate being your brother's keeper. A few years ago, I was at the Camp Beach Point auction, and as the auction was going on, my four-year-old Billy at the time was very bored with the auction, as happens, and so she wanted to go and play on the swing sets. So I followed her down there, and I was watching her as she in the playground area with some other kids. There were a bunch of other parents standing nearby chatting with one another when one little girl, who was even smaller than Billy, wandered away from the playset and just started heading off into the parking lot. And I shouted at the group of parents over here, "Does this little girl belong to anyone?" And they all looked up and went, "No." And then they turned back and started talking to one another again. So I didn't know quite what to do. I just watched the little girl walk away, but I kept her in view just to make sure that she didn't get into any danger. But I was standing there watching Billy and keeping an eye on this one. And this woman came running up to the swing set and to one of the older kids. And she said, "Where's your sister?" And the bigger girl said, You know, the mother said, "What is the one thing I told you to do?" The older girl went, watch my sister." She goes, "Yes." And I said, "It's all right. She's right over there." And the woman scampered off to take care of her. Thankfully, I could direct her to the little girl. But have any of you ever had that horrible empty feeling of, "Where's my kid? I don't know where they are." And wouldn't you be grateful that somebody is looking after them? Somebody has kept an eye on them. And I'm not blaming the big sister. I'm not blaming the mom. I'm not blaming the other parents who were standing around. And I'm certainly not exonerating myself, because I was torn with what to do. Leave my own child to run after somebody else's? I just tried to keep her in view and make sure that she was safe. We sometimes face a similar dilemma in church, don't we? How much is it our business when our brothers or our sisters sort of wander away? How much do we keep them in view and try to make sure that they're not in danger? When a brother or sister walks away or drops out, what is it to us? What is it to us? I mean, we've got our own problems. We've got our own failings, don't we? You know, we're busy enough trying to maintain our own following of Jesus without getting involved with somebody else. It might seem like what Jesus says here is reason to say, "Hey, what's it to me? As long as I'm following Jesus, everybody else has to be responsible for themselves." And we must resist that. These days, our society is rampantly self-absorbed and individualistic. It's obsessing our society. It's infected the church. My personal autonomy, my personal sovereignty is the reason behind a lot of the crazy stuff that we see going on. And I'm sorry to say that in many ways, Christianity has bought into these same values. You know, there's rugged individualism, which is a good thing and helped build the country. Standing on your own two feet, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, all of that kinds of, that's fine, except that there's one crucial place where it's not fine at all, and that's right here in the community of believers. Jesus has told us that we are His body. We are not lone rangers. We're made to be interdependent and mutually accountable and to rely upon one another. We have to learn to give to one another. We also have to learn to accept from one another. We know how our own bodies work, our physical bodies, and that the participation of the various bits aren't optional. Something we don't think about until one of those bits isn't functioning the way it is supposed to. And then suddenly we realize that every part of our body is hurt and affected when one part isn't functioning the way it's supposed to. It isn't an optional thing. It's actually life or death. And in America, the American way of following Jesus has the wonderful freedom to accommodate disparate viewpoints and interpretations and political preferences and all of that stuff. But it also has the great danger of allowing ourselves to become insulated and distant from one another because we tell ourselves, "It's none of my business." So let me emphasize, we cannot follow Jesus and neglect our brothers and sisters. Love and care for each other is part and parcel of following Jesus. Knowing about each other and caring for each other are not the same things. You can get on Facebook and learn everything that's going on with somebody else's life, but that's not the same as caring for them. We can't turn a blind eye to our brothers and sisters when they are walking away or walking in error. We have to get involved. So many excuses that we could throw out, and I'm a master of all of them, but they're just smoke screens for fear and for selfishness. We hear all the time about how the church in America is in decline and how Christians are on the wrong side of history, how politically, unpolitically correct we are, and so on. But none of that will be our undoing. You hear that? None of that will be our undoing. We can be as politically incorrect as possible. We can be on the wrong side of history. We can be out of step with the current society, all the rest of that stuff. None of that will be the undoing of the followers of Christ, of the church in America. We hear about out of touch with modern culture we are and how churches need to modernize their style. We need to get hip with the program of worship. We need to get up to date with where society is going. None of that is going to be our rescue. Here it is. The church will survive and thrive if we keep doing that which has set it apart and distinguished it from the day it was born, that we love one another, that we care for one another, and even for those who aren't part of our own. Every day is a unique, even today, that is a unique distinctive of the church and the unique opportunity and the place of the church. Now, I don't mean to toot your own horn here, but if I want an example of that, I would say visit this place on Monday, Wednesdays, Thursday nights, or Fridays when you see the volunteers of the food pantry interacting with Love Inc. clients. See what I did there? I snuck in a Love Inc. reference, and you guys didn't even notice it. But if you want to see that kind of caring for others, both within our midst and those outside of our midst, that's a great example. Think about the cost, the effort, the generosity that it takes to make that happen. Think of the hours and hours of volunteer labor it takes to make that happen. And it's just crazy unless you're following Jesus. When we love others, we are keeping Jesus squarely in view. Keeping Jesus squarely in view. One of my favorite movies is It's a Wonderful Life. And one of the great scenes, from a pastor's point of view anyway, is when George Bailey tries to explain to his customers at the savings and loan, when they all come in, and if you've seen this movie, as I have many, many times, everyone floods into the savings and loan and they want their money out. And George tries to explain to them, it isn't an institution, it's a mutually cooperative effort. He says, the money isn't here, it's in your house, and in your house, and in your house. It isn't a matter of the customers relating to the savings and loan. It's a matter of the customers relating to each other. When we love others, when we care for our brother and for our sister, we are keeping Jesus squarely in view. What's it to you means feeding his sheep. Secondly, what's it to you means following Jesus regardless of the good done by others. Now, you might think that's a funny thing to say. Following Jesus regardless of the good done by others. It means not becoming derailed or distracted or discouraged by somebody else's gifts, somebody else's ministry, somebody else's influence, or somebody else's success. Jesus says, you follow me. Feed my sheep. Not everybody has the same role. And that's not just with individuals within a church. That's churches within a community. That's churches even within the United States. Don't let the good work of somebody else distract you or discourage you in your own good work. Not everybody can go off and be a missionary. Not every pastor has the same skill set. Not every teacher is the same. If somebody's over here doing something great and amazing, don't think that you have to dump whatever it is that you're doing and run off and do that too. Not every church is a Saddleback or a Willow Creek. And the right formula isn't the answer. The answer is the church being the church with what God has given it in the community where God has put it with the people in that church. Not everybody is gifted the same, but everyone is gifted. Not everybody is gifted the same, but everyone is gifted. In God's economy, every gift is equally valuable and equally necessary. Every gift is equally valuable and equally necessary. You ever meet somebody who seems to have no weaknesses? You know, who seems overblessed with talents and capabilities? You know anybody like that? I do. I hate those people. With a pure Christian hatred, of course. that there's people who say, it doesn't seem like they can do anything wrong. You know, they're musically gifted. They can organize a meeting. They can charm a customer. They can whip up a lasagna. They can sew a patch on the knee of your jeans, and all while teaching a Bible study and juggling Ginsu knives. There are some people who just seem to have it all and are able to do it all. And maybe you know other people who aren't maybe spectacular, but they just seem a little bit better than you at everything that they do. Or maybe even just in one or two important areas. In other words, if you were looking for volunteers to do something, you would certainly want them to do it and not you. Now, I'm not talking about being envious or resentful of other people's abilities. I'm talking about a tendency to undervalue or ignore what we can do and our gifts. Sometimes when we see other people and the good that they are doing, we are distracted from what it is that God has gifted us to do, and so we don't do it. We undervalue, or sometimes we're even blind to the abilities that God has given us. We tend to think that, well, whatever I can do or whatever I can offer, that is so mediocre that there's just no point. There's no place for us. It's better to leave the field to others who are more capable or those who have more obvious gifts. And in short, we look at others and the way that God is using them, and it distracts us and it discourages us. We look at the success that maybe other individuals or other ministries are having, and we can't do that or think that that's impossible for us. And so we kind of shrug our shoulders and give up. We do not offer everything that we have and are to following Him, and in the end, it costs the church as a whole. Now consider Peter as a choice for leadership. We know his story. We know it, warts and all. We know that Peter is deeply flawed. He has glaring shortcomings. He's probably told himself that he has little, if anything, left to offer Jesus, especially after failing him so spectacularly. He probably has told himself he'd be best following in the background. Let someone more qualified with a better reputation take the lead. Jesus wasn't having it. He calls him up in front and he sets him to the task of feeding his sheep right in front of everybody. Now, if I could take a concrete example here, as a pastor, for years we would put announcements calling for volunteers of various kinds in every form of communication that we could think of. We would speak it from the pulpit. We would put it in newsletters. We'd put it in email blasts. We'd put it as an announcement in the bulletin. We'd have somebody come up and give special announcements. We need 15 recruits for our vacation Bible school, or we need somebody to bake cookies so that we have cookies for the coffee time after church, or all of these sorts of things. You know what I'm talking about. And then there'd be very, very few responses. And sometimes I would literally go to somebody and say, hey, have you seen, have you thought about getting involved in our vacation Bible school? And the response would be, yeah, but nobody asked me. So that's always a little bit frustrating. I wonder how many times for things like that and for so many other events, we want it and we hope it happens, but we're afraid to be the one to step forward. We hope that somebody else steps into those roles, and maybe after they've got their 15 people for vacation Bible school, then we'll timidly step forward and volunteer ourselves as an emergency substitute. Well, if nobody else turns up, you can phone me on that day or something. Or if absolutely, if you're absolutely desperate, then you can call me up to bake cookies. And I would add that if you call me to bake cookies, you must be really, really desperate. But because we're all busy and we all think that somebody else is better qualified. We all think that somebody else is better gifted. And we tend to look at what we are and what we have and what we can do, and we undervalue it. And so we don't offer it. We are distracted by other people who seem to do other things much better than we can do. And Jesus says, what's that to you? Regardless of how talented or gifted or able or better qualified somebody else is, do not let it distract you or discourage you from following Jesus. And realize that He has gifted you too, and He has a purpose in mind for each one of those gifts, even if that gift is time. So, following Jesus, what's it to you? Means feed His sheep. What's it to you means following Jesus regardless of the good that other people are doing. And lastly, what's it to you means following Jesus regardless of the bad done by others. Don't allow the bad that somebody else does to discourage or derail you. There's a story that I go back to often that illustrates this. The devil had finally decided to retire. That would be nice. And he was having a going out of business sale. And on all the tables around him in his yard, he had put the weapons and the tricks and the instruments he had used for millennia to hurt and to hinder God's people. Each device had a price tag on it. And most prices seemed to correspond with the apparent power of the device. Over here was lust, and over there was doubt, and over there was greed, and next to that was self-pity, and so on and so on. But on one table was a very worn, very obviously well-used piece of equipment, not much to look at, certainly not as impressive as that big shiny pride over there, or or as powerful as awesome fear over there. But the price tag on it was 10 times that of any other. So someone asked them, "Why is this device so much more expensive than all of the rest?" And the devil said, "Oh," he said, "that's discouragement." The customer said, "Why is it so expensive?" "Because when all of my other temptations fail, that one usually succeeds. Christians can stand up to a lot of big attacks, but a slow, steady grind of discouragement will often take them out of the fight. When other Christians, individuals, other churches, even whole denominations seem to stop following Jesus, it can be a major distraction. It can be extremely discouraging. When you have experienced, maybe you've experienced what I'm talking about on a more individual level, maybe you're not looking at the bigger scene, but maybe you've experienced the kind of news that just takes the wind out of your sails. Maybe a brother or sister with whom you used to have sweet fellowship and joyful service has apparently given up on following Jesus. Maybe someone who has an addiction that you love has relapsed. Maybe the perfect couple that you know has announced that they're divorcing. Maybe your own kids have grown indifferent to their faith. Article after article that I come across about the projected drop in Christianity in North America by 2050, if current trends continue. How Islam is going just a hair's breadth away from becoming the dominant world religion. How people are leaving Christianity in droves in the so-called sophisticated West. I read one of those articles recently. I have to say that the writer's glee was poorly concealed. It's also not the whole story. But when we see the bad that others are doing, what should our response be? Should I too rethink Christianity or even consider abandoning it because it isn't popular as it used to be? Should I modify my beliefs because several major denominations have? Am I missing the boat? It's easy to get distracted by what other Christians are doing, especially if what they are doing is something that you think they ought not to be doing. What should our response be? I know what Jesus' response would be. What's that to you? You follow me. Movie that I love is Apollo 13. If you haven't seen the film, it's about the mission of Apollo 13 to the moon and a mechanical disaster that occurred mid-flight, knocking out most of the power for the ship, leaving them with limited supplies and limited oxygen. And so they decided that rather than the safest thing for them to do is to try to orbit the moon and then slingshot themselves back to Earth. But as they set up for this and they rounded the moon and they came out of that, they asked themselves, how are we going to get back to Earth? All of our navigation equipment is knocked out. And suddenly one of the astronauts realized that he could see the Earth in the little triangular window at the front of the spacecraft. And he realized, all I have to do is keep Earth in that little window, he said, and I can get us home. May have to make some course corrections every now and then, but if I keep Jesus in that little, the Earth in that little window, I can get us home. In a similar way, the call to us is to make sure that we keep Jesus squarely in view. Keep Jesus squarely in view, and he'll get us home. We do that by making sure that we are loving our brothers and sisters, both within this congregation and outside of it. Feed his sheep, and we will keep Jesus securely in view. Don't be distracted by the good that others are doing. Remember that God has gifted you, and he wants you to use those gifts, because every gift is equally valuable and necessary. Do that, and you will keep Jesus securely in view. Don't be distracted by the bad that others are doing. Realize that Jesus is responsible for them. You are responsible for keeping him firmly in view. Feed his sheep. Follow Jesus. You are your brother's keeper. Feed his sheep. Follow Jesus, even if others seem better at it than you or have lots more sheep than you. Feed his sheep. Follow Jesus, even if others have stopped following. Fix your eyes on Jesus, the one who began and the one who will perfect our faith. Keep him squarely in view and follow him. Join me in prayer. Lord, we read from this story that the distractions, the other things where we could be pointing our eyes and our attention, began immediately. And the pressures and the distractions seem even greater today. So we ask the help of your Holy Spirit that we would keep you in view, and that we would be reminded that regardless of what others do, good or bad, that you have called us to use our gifts to feed your sheep and to keep you in view and follow you. Amen.